In today's episode of the Nutrition and Life podcast, I speak with Dr. Brett Schoenfeld, researcher, educator, and author of The Max Muscle Plan, as well as The Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy. Brett and I speak about how we can manipulate resistance training variables to optimize hypertrophy in things like cheat reps versus strict reps or full range of motion versus lengthened partials. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Brett. And please, if you enjoy this show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Brett. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Dr. Brett Schoenfeld, researcher, educator, and author of The Max Muscle Plan, as well as Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
I'm super excited to have you on and to speak about all kinds of things when it comes to resistance training and how we can manipulate the variables in regards to that. But before we do, I would love to just have a little bit of a background of who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I mean, you gave the good overview, but I don't want to take up too much time with that, but I started out as a personal trainer on my own private training facility for many years, and then basically got the bug. I got the research bug, and I started to really take deep dives into research, decided my calling was as an educator. I went back, got my PhD, and I've been in academia now for 15 years. And I, as you mentioned, I'm a researcher and educator, and I've published close to 400 peer-reviewed research papers with a focus. My primary focus is on applied muscle development.
Amazing. Very good. Well, most of our audience is going to be engaging in some sort of resistance training, at least I hope so. So I can't wait to dig into all things muscle hypertrophy and get really into the specifics of the particular variables. So I know that that especially in your most recent book, you talk a lot about these individual variables. And so I would love for us to actually go through kind of almost each one of them. So for example, how many times per week should we actually be training in order to see hypertrophy?
Yeah, so I want to, before even taking that that course, make a point to say that there is no, in general, we don't have all the answers through science. Science provides certain guidelines, but there are limitations to what science is going to be able to do for us. So when I'm giving these types of talks, I can talk in some generalities and show what the research or discuss what the research shows, but it's not like everyone is going to have the same plan because the variables are interactive. When you manipulate one variable, you generally will manipulate others or at least cause issues with others. So there's interactions between variables that have to be taken into account. So things cannot necessarily be looked at in a vacuum, and there are caveats based on age and training experience and how you're configuring routines. So many things will enter into this. As far as training frequency, there is some evidence that, we don't have what I would say is, as far as the scope of evidence here, when we go from weak evidence to strong evidence, we don't have very strong evidence. So there's some conflicting evidence, but at least one time a week is necessary, depending upon how you're structuring your team. I think there's the suggestion that twice a week may, in some cases, training a muscle group, by the way, not the how many times a week you need to train is probably a minimum of 3 days a week if you want to optimize muscle development. But as far as how many times you train a given muscle group, probably two, there's at least the suggestion that two may have some mild effects over one. There's also some evidence that it really depends on the volume of training. So when you're at somewhat low to moderate volumes below, let's say 10 sets per muscle in a given session. So let's say you're going to do three sets of flies and three sets of flat presses and three sets of incline presses for your chest. Probably one day you can do that in 1 day a week and not sacrifice much, if anything, if you're doing that on a weekly basis. If you're going to move up to, let's say, six sets of each, where you're doing 18 sets, or let's say five sets of each, 15 sets, it probably is better to split that up into twice a week doing six to seven sets. So as you're getting more volume, you want to disperse the volume over more frequent sessions.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think also just that notion or caution, I guess, rather to individualize and to build on where you are at the moment, not jumping from, oh, okay, we're recording this in January. So sort of going from not training at all to 20 sets per week or something like that. Or we don't necessarily need to be doing that. That makes a lot of sense. And so then breaking the training days down further. When we're talking about specific sets for a certain exercise, I mean, the common standard is like 3 to 5 for a specific exercise, but not necessarily per muscle group. But what does the research say when it comes to each muscle group and how many sets we need to be doing?
So the evidence on volume per muscle group is somewhat extrapolated. We don't have research that has looked at like doing a certain amount of volume for at least higher amounts of volume for all the muscle groups. So we often look at what's talked about in the literature is 10 to 20 sets per muscle per week to optimize muscle growth. That's an extrapolation because the studies that have been carried out are really specific to small amounts of exercise of muscle groups. We don't have generally they'll look at, let's say, the quads and the biceps and triceps, but they won't look at, your total back and your chest. So if you look at the if you were doing 20 sets per muscle group for all your muscle groups, that's 180 sets. Now, certainly that may be certainly doable, and certainly a lot of the old school bodybuilders did that, but I think you have to look at it from a more nuanced standpoint and say, what is the total amount of sets per your total body per week? And maybe that is somewhere around like 90 to 180. That would be 10 to 20 sets if you're adding up all those muscles. Then it comes down to how you want to apportion that. And these are just, by the way, so several things to that. Number one, these are general estimates. It's no magic thing, magic number. Where if you're doing 9 sets per muscle, that all of a sudden you're lagging. I will say this, that doing minimalistic type of routines can get you the majority of your gains. So, using routines that have 4 to 6 sets a week will generally provide a good majority of the gains, depending on the person. And there's inter-individual responses, as you kind of pointed out earlier, where some people will generally need more volume than others. I think you also need to look at apportioning volume to the muscles that are lagging versus, so at least logically speaking, it's called specialization cycles, where you want to give the lagging muscle groups more volume. And if you're going to do that, you generally want to give less volume to the better developed muscle groups so that you can keep your total volume somewhat manageable. And we don't have any good evidence of really overtraining from resistance training from a volume standpoint in the literature, but the studies are relatively short term. You're talking 8 to 12 weeks. Whereas if you're going to do that over the course of time, that certainly can start to wear on you. And that leads to another point that you necessarily need to look at volume in terms of doing the same amount of volume, let's say for your muscle groups every week, or in my humble opinion, and something that I've advocated doing, at least logically, is to periodize your volume, where you go from periods of somewhat lower volume, then you go to a more moderate volume, and then a higher volume. You can have blocks of 1 month or 6 weeks, or again, no, there are no rules as far as this goes, but look to give your body this push to where it has a short overreaching, functional overreaching phase, and then you go back to you can deload. So there's other strategies to employ to make sure you don't overtrain, and then go back to a lower, then moderate, then higher volume, and look at that cyclically.
Yeah, I love that cyclical periodized approach. And with regards to that, a brief question in terms of deloads, are you an advocate for autoregulation when it comes to that, or more so of a structured approach straight away?
Yeah, I am, and my thoughts on this have somewhat changed. I used to be more of a proponent. My thought was is that most people do not accurately gauge their overtraining status, their recovery status, and that thus having kind of regulating it for people would be a better for the majority of people. But Our group carried out a study on this, and it did not show that a fixed deload period actually was successful for that regard. And I do, it kind of made me reconsider. And I think at this point, auto regulating, and by the way, it did seem that the people, the subjects in our study, had a pretty good sense of where they were at. And yeah, I think at this point, I'm more on the bandwagon of letting people, at least more experienced lifters, make their own determination. And again, you have to be able to be honest about it, because some people, they just think that if they give up, they deload at all, they're going to lose their gains. So if, as long as someone can be honest and objectively, subjectively assess their recovery, then I think it's a better strategy.
Awesome. Okay, thank you. Okay, now going further down the line with when it comes to reps, what does research tell us when it comes to a rep cadence as for optimizing hypertrophy?
Cadence, tempo. So a fairly wide range of tempos is sufficient. Generally speaking, anywhere between 1 to 3 or 4 seconds, both for concentric and eccentric, seem to have somewhat similar effects. I would say a couple of things. Number one, on the eccentric, I would tend to gravitate more to. You have to at least make sure you're lowering under control. Some people with 1 second, they're more ballistic about it and they just kind of let the weight drop, so the muscles aren't doing any work. And that certainly would be, at least by a logical basis, not a good strategy. But my opinion on tempo at this point is to focus on the mind-muscle connection, to think about, I don't think you really need to think about how fast you're lifting per se. I think you need to feel the muscle, which is going to basically, if you do that, you're going to take into account, you're going to allow tempo to take care of itself. So my general recommendation is to feel the muscle. We actually published a study on this topic that had some support for a mind-muscle connection. One of the biceps seemed to show an effect, and the quads actually did. But there were reasons why there might not have been as successful for the quads in the population we studied. Anyway, I just think it's a, at this point, without good evidence to refute it, I think it's a good strategy. I don't see a downside to it, and I think that cost benefit. If you use a mind-muscle connection, the tempo will take care of itself, basically.
Yeah, from a personal perspective, I used to train more or come from like a functional training background, CrossFit style. So, you're not really focused on feeling a muscle at all. And over the last 2.5, 3 years, I have really shifted more into the hypertrophy space and quote unquote tried establishing a better mind muscle connection, especially to those lagging body parts. And for me, it has made a world of a difference slowing down my reps, especially kind of like holding isometrically, just very, very briefly, for instance, at the bottom of the squat, so that I don't lose the tension there in a particular muscle or just in other areas as well. The slowing it down for me personally has helped a lot, absolutely. And so then when it comes to the repetition numbers, there's so many things thrown around, sometimes that good old bodybuilding range. Is there really any truth to that, 8 to 12, or do we build muscle lower as well? What does the research say really?
Yeah, so again, this is another area where I've really shifted my opinion, almost pretty much a 180. Whereas I used to be a big proponent of that hypertrophy range. It was right out of the NSCA textbook, and the reasons that these logical reasons why I thought it was seemed like an effective rep range, and it is. So it's certainly, I'm not saying it's not an effective rep range, and I generally would defer and think it's a good general strategy to train in that range. But the literature actually, I mean, this is more conclusive than almost on any other variable. Here's where the research is very strong, in my opinion, that you can make similar whole muscle gains across a wide spectrum of loading ranges, anywhere between, 3 to 5, all the way up to 30 plus reps. When you start getting into very, 50, 60, 70 reps, there seems to be an attenuation of gains. That probably is because people just get bored and they're not going, they quit before they actually are fatiguing the muscle sufficiently. But yeah, you can make very similar gains on a whole muscle basis. There doesn't seem to be much of any difference. Now, there may be, and this is where it's much more equivocal. I don't think it's certainly there's not good evidence on this, but there is some evidence to show there may be fiber type specific benefits where higher reps tend to may tend to hypertrophy the type one fibers, your slow twitch fibers to a greater degree, and vice versa. Your heavier loads may tend to hypertrophy the faster twitch fibers, the type two fibers. Again, the evidence is equivocal here, but without evidence to the contrary, good evidence to the contrary, I think it's a good general recommendation if your goal is to optimize gains, is to at least have some lighter load and some heavier load training. But I also will say that the majority of training should probably, I'm going to say should be, I think it's effective to be within that 6 to 12, 6 to 15 rep range. It's an efficient rep range. So it provides, I think, a good balance of the heaviness of load. I think you generally can get most of your fiber types involved at that point where you're kind of hitting the spectrum. But even with that, let's say if 60, 70% of your training is done within that rep range, then you have certainly then the higher range in 20 to 30 reps and possibly even the 3 to 5, having some training done in those ranges may help enhance for various reasons, not only fiber type reasons, but higher reps may help with buffering capacity, which can help to get an extra squeeze out an extra rep or two in your moderate rep range, and doing sets in your 3 to 5 may help to use heavier loads during your more moderate rep training. So I just think there's a good logical basis for it, and I don't see a downside.
I think that's really great news because it means we don't need to get so caught up in the specifics of like, oh no, one day I trained more in the 8 rep range and the other day I had only lighter weights and I trained in 20, and we can really benefit from having that wide variety, especially if we add to that rep cadence and then, slowing it down and perhaps only doing 6 reps, but still getting a really great benefit because we have such long time under tension. I do think what needs to be a paid attention to with that is that sometimes, at least in my opinion, the lower rep heavier load training can sometimes be a little bit more strenuous for the nervous system, perhaps if we constantly train really, really heavy. I don't know what your opinion is on that.
Well, when you say strenuous for the nervous system adapts. I don't know of any evidence that training heavy, again, it depends how you manage your
Right.
fatigue. That would be detrimental over time. What I will say is if you're always in that rep range, it's going to generally be, can certainly be detrimental to your joint health. So I think that in itself is a reason why you don't want to, power lifters tend to have a lot of joint-related issues, or often do. So I am not a fan of, or I should say I'm not a fan. I am a fan of using some lighter load training and not specifically, it's not, by the way, for if your goal is muscle building. So all the discussion we've had, and I think that's where you want to focus, is on muscle building. When you're talking about strength, it's a different animal. So to maximize
100%.
strength, you definitely need to train with your heavier loads. But what I would say is that, if you want to just build muscle, if your primary focus is building muscle and you're just focusing on that 3 to 5 rep range, you're going to have to do more sets to make up for the some of the research that we have from our lab shows that on a set on a volume, I'm sorry, on a volume set equated basis, that you're going to sacrifice gains if you're in a very heavy, low rep environment.
Yeah, that's a very good note there. And I liked your recommendation earlier in terms of training with various rep ranges, lower and higher rep ranges. So then, with regards to the execution of that as well, what kind of rest times in between sets should we be looking at?
Yeah, so we actually just published a meta-analysis fairly recently, a few months ago, on this. And it's kind of interesting because the old school recommendations, again, you go back to the Anesthesia textbook, and I was a board of directors member for the Anesthesia, so I love the organization. But you go back to the Anesthesia textbook, which is generally the Bible of strength conditioning, and it had advocated short rest periods for hypertrophy training. And the primary reason was based on what is called the hormone hypothesis, where if you have shorter rest, it helps to elevate your testosterone and IGF-1 and growth hormone levels immediately post-exercise for about an hour or so. And that was thought to kickstart the growth process. And basically, much of the research now shows that it doesn't have significant, if even any, benefits in that regard. And actually, the research points to the fact that it's detrimental, somewhat detrimental, to take very short rest periods. So the evidence that we produced through this meta-analysis seemed to show that you should be above 90 seconds or above. And I think here again, this is where some nuance is required. We don't have, I think the evidence, we need more research on this, but I think the type of exercise needs to be considered here. So if you're doing squats, I think you're going to need longer rest periods than if you're doing, let's say, lateral raises or biceps curls. So you could get away with 90 seconds or so for your biceps curls, your lateral raises. I think for squats to optimize results, probably, two, 3 minutes would be a better gauge. And it also depends on your proximity to failure. So when you're going closer to failure, to failure, you're going to have, it's going to impair your recovery interest, intercept recovery. So taking some longer rest. And by the way, when we're talking here again about optimization, how big a difference this has on your gains is not, it's not like you don't get gains from training with shorter rest, but it will somewhat sacrifice your gains. And if you're a bodybuilder or someone who is seeking to optimize their genetic potential, it can make a difference.
Yeah, and to the point of the exercise specific selection there as well, maybe also like in terms of superset training or something like that, perhaps you could do a leg extension and then lateral raise, and you don't need to rest for quite that long if you really wanted to save some time.
Yeah, we actually have one of my students, Ryan Burke, shout out to him, did this for his master, excuse me, his master's thesis. And he did, we looked at supersets and trained individuals and showed no difference between, we did paired supersets, so biceps, triceps, quads, and hamstrings, and very similar gains. So yeah, it's a good way if you want. Now, again, some caveats to that research that it was only on a limited number of exercises. If you're going to superset all your muscle groups in every session, could there be an interference effect that starts to happen from, too much training density? It's possible.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier when we were talking about rep cadence, and that someone might perhaps go qu rather quick on the eccentric part and so on. That leads me to the thought of kind of like quote unquote cheat reps versus strict reps. What do we have? What research do we have when it comes to those kind of things?
Well, it's apropos you ask because one of my former now master's students, Francesca Augustin, just published her, or I'm sorry, just finished her. It's now in review. Just finished her thesis study, looking at that exact topic on cheat reps versus strict reps. And again, the evidence does not seem to show much difference between doing cheat reps. And this was cheat reps on every repetition.
Oh.
So it was cheat reps on every repetition versus strict reps. And now, as I've hopefully hit home, that there are caveats and there's limitations to a lot of this research. We just looked at biceps, triceps in this, and they were untrained individuals. So I think what the research, what our study seemed to show, was that form may not be as important. Strict form may not be as important as otherwise thought. But it is certainly the study cannot be taken to mean that you could just do whatever form you want, because over time, certainly logically, you can increase your chance of injury if you're not doing, I think, sticking to a fairly close form. And also, we didn't look at, let's say, doing strict reps, and then at the end of the set, using the last few reps for cheat reps when you're coming close to failure, to get out an extra few reps. So there's other ways you might want to use cheat reps that may help to enhance that effect. But again, this was the first study on the topic. There was never a study, so long way to go before I would have strong conclusions on that topic.
Yeah, that's very interesting that outcome surprises me. To be honest, I did hear sometimes that, the last two, three reps, when you get closer to failure, using a little bit more momentum, that that's can might even be advantageous, or at least equally as good. But I'm surprised that doing performing all reps as sort of cheat reps is or seems to be just as efficient, at least in novice trainers. Of course, as you mentioned too, like it depends on what exercise, because if we're sort of cheating on specific exercises where we might get injured because of that, it's probably a whole different ball game. But that, yeah, very, very interesting. And so taking that a step further, because sometimes people cheat by not going into the full range of motion. And I don't know if we want to consider that cheating or not, but let's say like someone does pull-ups or any kind of other exercise like that. Sometimes I see people like that in the gym and I think to myself, that's not a full repetition. Come on. But I know that you have been involved in some research that pertains to full range of motion versus sort of partial range of motion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll start by saying it's not cheating if you're doing it purposefully. So it would depend upon whether you're doing that because for a given reason, for a hopeful outcome, or you're just doing it because you don't know or because it's easier. But yeah, so it's an interesting line of research. And we have, I think, a good amount of research showing that short and partial, so doing the, let's say, if you're doing, for instance, in a shoulder press, doing this would be a short and partial, so the top portion of the movement, versus a lengthened partial, which would be the bottom part portion of the movement. So from the start to the first half versus the midpoint to the second half, the lengthened portion fairly consistently comes out ahead from a muscle development standpoint. With strength, it's going to be specific to the range that's training. So you'll get more strength on the given range that you're training in as a general. From a muscle development, we seem to show better hypertrophy for the lengthened portion when it's compared to the shortened portion. Now, when it's compared to a full range of motion, there is generally, on most cases, there does not seem to be much difference. I mean, you can look at it two ways. From a hypertrophy standpoint, you can pretty much, at least on most exercises, or on many exercises, do just the lengthened portion, seem to get similar results as you can with a full range of motion, assuming you're using similar repetition ranges and going using similar intensities of effort so that you're going close to failure. Similarly, you have to obviously use heavier loads when you're doing a partial versus a full range of motion. A few caveats to that. We haven't looked at it in all the different muscle groups. There may be certain muscle groups. Shout out to my best bud, Brett Contreras, who you might know. He's certainly has speculated that the glutes may work or better in a short position on certain exercises, and perhaps the hip thrust may promote synergistic effects for the squat for that reason. We don't have good evidence either way. It hasn't been studied to look at that. I'd also say that if you're now from a flexibility standpoint, you'll get good flexibility from staying in that lengthened portion. But if you're missing out on the end range of motion with the full range, you're going to somewhat stagnate your strength gains in that range, which may be, I think for most people, probably would be an issue. So I think these are things that potentially should be taken into account. We can't speak universally for on all the muscle groups because we don't have evidence on all the muscle groups, and we have limited evidence on it's been most studied in the quads, and many of the other muscle groups have less research on it where to draw strong conclusions.
I could imagine trying it or testing it for an exercise like the leg extension or something like that for at least a certain period of time and just seeing how it feels different. I don't necessarily know that I personally would like to do just bottom half squats all the time. That sounds really brutal, to be honest. But yeah.
I will say that a strategy that could be employed potentially to take advantage of this is to do full range of motion at or close to failure and then pump out some extra reps in partial. So we can, let's say you're doing a bench press and you're getting close to failure, you can just do several partial reps. And we actually have evidence. A colleague of mine recently, I'm not sure whether it's been published yet, but certainly he completed the study and it's been online, looked at that strategy, doing lengthened partials as extenders, set extenders, and actually has shown that that benefits hypertrophy, or at least in the context studied.
Very cool. That's good to know. I might test it out in that sense then. And you touched on a failure here a couple of times, or you mentioned going close to failure a couple of times. Maybe you can also share with us what the research says when it comes to proximity to failure.
Yeah, so again, I came from the old bodybuilding school thought process of you either go all out or go home. And if I was not only going to failure, but getting some forced reps and doing some drop sets in there, then I really wasn't getting an effective workout. And really, the evidence is starting to be, I think, fairly compelling that if you're within a couple reps, you still need to train really hard. So you have to be fairly close to failure. I would say probably two, maybe three reps. It would depend on the exercise and the rep range. So certain things may be, there's some nuance to that. But within that, you don't necessarily need to go to failure to make, or at least I think that is the general consensus. Now, I will say this, that could there be a benefit to selectively going to failure on at least some of your sets? I still don't think we have enough evidence to refute that. Maybe it's my personal bias from being a former bodybuilder and coming from that school, but I think that you can at least make a logical case when people get closer to their genetic ceiling. So very advanced lifters, bodybuilders, it may be a tool to help to promote progressive overload, so to take you to a point, basically take you beyond your present capacity in ways you might not be able to do otherwise. So I think maybe using it on the last set can be an effective strategy. Certainly, I don't think you need, and I think there even can be somewhat of a detrimental effect from doing it on all sets. But perhaps selectively using it on the last set, and I think even more so, you have to look at the exercises as well. So squats, if you do a failure, would have more of a fatiguing effect than if you did, again, a lateral raise to failure. So perhaps using it more on your less complex exercises. And the other thing I would say is that to estimate RIR properly, you need to know what failure is. And thus, I do think that at least early in your training career, you should experience failure, on a fairly consistent basis for a period of at least months. I mean, I did it for many years. So, I mean, I know complete knowledge of what failure is and can apply that. But I don't think that you need to do it for many years. But I do think certainly several months of training the failure, at least selectively, would be beneficial to your understanding of where your RIR is.
Yeah, I would say at least from my more limited experience with training with our clients, I would say that generally speaking, the majority of them probably hold back a little bit too much, or they think, oh, it's starting to feel hard, so I should stop. That means I'm getting closer to failure. But just because something is starting to feel hard does not mean you're nowhere near failure. I think the research does support that actually, right? When you're encouraged, or when someone's like yelling at you or something like that, when it's supervised, that people generally are able to push themselves harder, or that they rather said, I guess, that they generally have a hard time gauging how close they are to failure. They might say, oh, this feels like I'm too away from failure. And then when they're being pushed, they are actually able to put out another 5 reps or something like that. And then so lastly, I wanted to talk to you about something I read recently in on your content, and that was the question whether one set is enough per week. So one set per muscle group, or I assume that was is enough per week in order to maintain muscle mass, or even to add a little bit of muscle mass. And I guess you sort of touched on that initially, but maybe you can just expand on that.
Yeah, so it wasn't one set per week. It was single set routine. So let's say for the legs, we did a total body routine twice a week, and these were resistance training subjects. And let's say for the legs, we did one set of squats, one set of leg presses and one set of leg extensions twice a week. That's six sets per week. For
Gotcha.
the arms, it was four sets per week for the arms. So you have to look at the study in that context. And yeah, as I mentioned earlier, the subjects got quite good gains. And the takeaway is that, that we didn't compare it to a higher volume routine, but that's been done in the past from our group and others. So there is generally the literature, I think, quite compellingly shows a dose response relationship to volume, at least up to a certain point in isolation. But I also am an advocate, like, if you're not a bodybuilder, I think that single set routines can be quite effective. You can get really good gains in a fraction of the time. So, I think as people become busier, if you're not a bodybuilder or someone that is just focused on maximal gains, single set routines can be an extremely attractive option. And again, from our study, even twice a week, if you did that three times, it was a half hour session twice a week, so 1 hour a week. If you do it three times a week, get even a little more volume out of that, again, you might have even more gains.
That, I think that's a really, really great message for people out there because oftentimes I guess people think like, oh, it's not worth it. I only have 30 minutes, or I can only go on Tuesdays and Saturdays because of family things. So yeah, a really, really great message. Now, Brad, just to round off with, I would love to hear what exactly your both of your books are about and kind of like the differences between the two. So the first one being the Max Muscle Plan, and then the second one, Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy.
Yeah, they're both science-based books. The Max Muscle Plan is more geared towards the consumer to make them understand the science of training, hypertrophy training. And the Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy is my life's work, really. It's a textbook on it gets really deep into the research. It's for people that I would say you need to have a good foundation of science to appreciate that book. Probably an undergrad degree would help, but if not, certainly more of a science-based background that you're at least have a basic understanding of exercise physiology, etc.
Okay, wonderful. Well, so the first one, Max Muscle Plan, literally is kind of like a plan on how to set yourself up or create your own program if you wanted to. And then the second one sounds like it's more to gain the understanding about the methods. Perfect. Okay, well, Brad, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I will absolutely make sure to put all your handles in the show notes and, of course, also the links to the two books. But I think you've given us a wonderful overview of what science at the moment says about how to optimize hypertrophy training.
My pleasure, Lisa.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brett. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.